Hello and welcome to this episode of the Christmas Alphabet Podcast. My name's Wayne, I'm your host, guiding you through Christmas facts, feelings and history every 2 weeks all year round, and we do it in alphabetical order. I'm based in Manchester in England, but we have a worldwide view of Christmas. Every episode looks at anything to do with Christmas that starts with one single letter of the alphabet. Today we're on to probably the most popular letter of all. It's episode S of the Christmas Alphabet Podcast. We've got a sack full of stuff today, including Santa Claus, snowmen and the snowman, Saturnalia, the stable, the shepherds, the Star of Bethlehem, and several songs, including Silent Night, Santa Claus is Coming to Town, Silver Bells, and Sleigh Ride. And it's all here on the Christmas Alphabet Podcast. So today we're on to the letter S, and S is for Santa Claus. Yep, let's jump in at the deep end and look at the long and complex history of everyone's favourite present provider, Santa Claus. He's the hero of a million films and stories and books and TV specials. He's a cultural icon and the personification of Christmas in much of the world. Now, if you were here with me for our F episode, you'll know that I've been to F is for Father Christmas. And here in Britain, we have a long tradition of Father Christmas, longer than the Santa tradition. And Father Christmas is not the same as Santa, except that over the last 100 years, the two blokes, Father Christmas and Santa Claus, have kind of merged into one. Santa has also gobbled up a lot of other traditions of gift givers in other countries. The French Père Noël, the Russian Dead Moroz, and the Dutch and South European St. Nicholas. All of them are becoming more and more and more like the American Santa Claus. So, let's dig into Santa Claus and his origins. Young children may want to look away now. Santa Claus is just another way of saying Saint Nicholas. It comes from the old Dutch. That's the name of Santa Claus in that language. And that's a clue to the modern roots of Santa Claus. St. Nicholas, as we know, was a 3rd century bishop born in Turkey, but reverence for him was massive in the 17th century and onwards in the Netherlands. Families would meet for big celebrations and to exchange presents. Gifts would be given to children, with toys for good boys and girls and bundles of sticks or canes for naughty children. Except this wasn't at Christmas. This was on December the 5th. St. Nicholas Eve. Dutch people moved to New York. It was originally called New Amsterdam. And they took Sinterklaas with them, and all the legends and traditions that had grown up around him. By the 18th century, Sinterklaas, St. Nicholas in Dutch, was merging with the English Father Christmas to become Santa Claus, a character who brings presents at Christmas to good boys and girls. Through the 19th century, Santa became who he is today. Washington Irving was a big part of that, as was the Visit from St. Nicholas poem, The Night Before Christmas. The tradition was still centred on New York, but it spread throughout the United States and then further afield. The Civil War artist Thomas Nast used pictures of Santa for propaganda purposes, which fixed his appearance in many people's imagination. He was forever now a large and jolly man with a white beard. His red fur-trimmed coat was derived from the Dutch jackets that were fashionable back in the 17th century. You can see them on the Dutch master's paintings. And these were often worn for St. Nicholas Day celebrations. Santa's 20th century image was made more popular in 1930s through Coca-Cola's advertising. It's not true that Coke invented the red suit, but the bright red of Santa's jacket did go well with Coke's corporate colours and were exploited by their artist Haddon Sundblom. But Sundblom's pictures also drew from his Swedish background and the traditional figures of Jultomte and the paintings of Jenny Nyström. So, Santa Claus, as we know him today, is a mixture Turkish and Dutch and English and Swedish and American, are very much a world citizen. These days, there's so many Santa traditions that we take for granted, and so many books have been written about them. It's an endless source of study and fascination. Why does Santa say ho ho ho? Why does he have reindeer and elves and a workshop? And what about letters to Santa? And those Santa trackers that seem to be everywhere each Christmas Eve? There's even books written about what speed Santa would have to travel to deliver all his gifts in one night. Some of these are featured in other episodes of this podcast. Some are just worth investigating. Then there's a whole podcast about what we should tell our children, and what the stories of Santa Claus say about us as a society. But I'm afraid for now, it's time to move on. S is for the endlessly fascinating story of Santa Claus. And this is the Christmas Alphabet Podcast. Today we're on the letter S in the Christmas Alphabet Podcast, where S is for three items in the story of the birth of Jesus, though there's one odd one out. If I tell you the three are the stable, the shepherds, and the Star of Bethlehem. The popular account of the first Christmas includes these three S's, but the odd one out is the one that isn't in the Bible at all. That odd one out is S for stable. The Bible says Christmas started when Jesus was born in Bethlehem. He had an ordinary birth among poor people, and Luke's Gospel tells us that Jesus, when he was born, was wrapped in cloths and laid in a manger, because there was no room at the inn, or as it says in more modern versions, no guest room available for them. Being wrapped in cloths was normal for babies. It's how they were kept warm and safe. Being put in a manger, an animal's feeding trough, wasn't the most normal thing to do. But it's explained that the baby went where the animals eat because the couples weren't in a guest room or a hotel room. But in that time and place, your animals lived in your house with you. Not in anything like a stable, that's a medieval thing. It's most likely that Mary and Joseph and the baby were left in the lower floor of a peasant house where the animals were kept. The stable was indeed an invention of later times, and has become part of our picture of the nativity scene, but it's not here in the original story. But S is for stable, and S is also for the shepherds, who are in the Bible, and they're in Luke's Gospel. The shepherds were the first people to get an invitation to a Christmas party to go and see the baby. The shepherds may have been Bedouin people with no fixed homes, or they could have been farm workers, or priestly people who were preparing lambs for the Passover. We're not really told. We do know they were on the hills near Bethlehem, when at first one angel, and then loads of angels, tell them a special baby has been born. This baby is the Messiah, that is the promised one, and he is the Lord. So they go to Bethlehem and find the baby in the manger. Then they go off again and tell everyone what the angels told them about this baby. The shepherds represent the poor and ordinary people who are the first to hear of the birth of Jesus. They are the everyman, the you and me, if you like, the ones who never expected to be included in God's plan. And here they are. Christmas is all around them. S is for shepherds. And the third in our three nativity S's, S is for the Star of Bethlehem. The star we're talking about here, of course, is the one that's in Matthew's Gospel. We read of some wise men, or magi, who are from the east, who turn up in Jerusalem looking for a new king. It seems they've been stargazing, and they've seen a star rising in the sky which told them that a new king was born in Israel. The Bible doesn't say it was a new star or a specially bright star, and it doesn't say the wise men followed the star to Jerusalem. But for the wise men, this was a significant star that had a message for them that they couldn't ignore. So they'd come to worship a new king whose star had been the messenger. The wise men are told that the new king has to be born in Bethlehem. And then the star appears again and seems to move in the sky right over the house where the child is with his mother Mary. So that's what we call the Star of Bethlehem. Like the stable, the Bible account of the star gets stylized and magnified in retellings of the story and in every picture you've ever seen of it. The star becomes a magnificent new beacon in the sky. It becomes a star of wonder, star of light, star with royal beauty bright. Where did that idea come from? It becomes a signpost on a long journey being followed faithfully from one country to another. It becomes a character in a nativity play, an icon in its own right, an image on cards and nativity scenes, and a central symbol of Christmas. So much has been built up around this star. And there's one more thing to say about the Star of Bethlehem, is what it actually was. Now, I know some people say, well, it was just all made up. And some say it was a supernatural light simply put there by God. One theory says it was the angels in the sky appearing to the shepherds, spotted by the wise men from thousands of miles away. But if the Magi were astronomers who saw significance in the sky, they may well have seen a natural event that science can explain. A lot of the theories around this surround the planet Jupiter. Jupiter has in ancient times always represented the king of the heavenly bodies, and seeing its rising in an unusual situation may well have been significant for the Magi. One popular explanation that goes back to the astronomer Kepler in the 1600s is that Jupiter and Saturn seem to come very close together in the sky in 7 BC. Another account is that Jupiter rose in the east in close conjunction with the moon in 6 BC. Jupiter and Venus were also part of seven conjunctions in 3 BC. And all these ideas and many others have been argued at different times for what caught the attention of the Magi. We'll never know what it really was, but it's interesting to speculate. S is for the Star of Bethlehem, and for the shepherds, and for the stable that never was. Do you call that an unstable? This is the Christmas Alphabet Podcast. My name's Wayne. Thanks for being with us today. Today we're looking at the letter S on the Christmas Alphabet Podcast. Really, we've got enough today to fill two or three long episodes. This is already a bumper episode of the podcast. Thanks for staying with us. S is for snowmen. Of course, snowmen have got nothing to do with Christmas except, well, they have. Most of our Christmas imagery and imagination is set in the Northern Hemisphere winter, which is supposedly a wonderful world of snow, though it never seems to snow at Christmas where I live. And snow means having fun, throwing snowballs and making snow models, particularly snowmen and women. Snow means having fun, unless you're old and grumpy, and snow just means getting cold and not being able to get to work. Anyway, enough of me. The snowman is part of our picture of the fun and freedom of Christmas. Snowmen, models of people made out of snow, have been around for as long as there have been people and snow. There are pictures of them going back to the 14th century. The sculptor, Michelangelo, is said to have made a beautiful snow sculpture of a man in 1494. Unfortunately, it's gone now. The first photograph of a snowman was taken in 1845, which was pretty much when the camera was invented. Snowmen have been with us, in reality and in pictures, forever and ever. Now here's a question. How do you build a snowman and what should it look like? This is where it gets interesting. Because the basic snowman is quite different in the States from the version of a snowman in Britain and I think in other parts of Europe. Our snowman, the one I grew up with in England, starts with one big ball for the body. usually elongated into more of a cylinder than a ball by patting it down round the sides, but it's always just one piece. And then this piece has a second snowball, a very round one this time, put on top of it for the head. It's a two-piece snowman. But in America, more often, the classic snowman is made of three snowballs, two round snowballs for the body, and then a third one for the head. This may seem like a minor difference, but it's actually a massive contrast in design and in appearance. Have a look at them in the pictures, and I assure you, although what I'm saying sounds like nonsense, it will check out. How do you make a snowman? Let me know. Have a look at the snowman in the Raymond Briggs animation called The Snowman, the one who flies through the air. Look at the one the boy makes, particularly before he comes alive and has legs. That one is like a pillar of snow with a small round ball of a head. And he has snow arms stuck to his side, and he's wearing a scarf and a hat. That is your absolute classic British snowman. Now compare him with Olaf, the snowman in the film Frozen. Olaf is three balls of snow of roughly equal size, like three marshmallows heaped up. And Olaf's arms are sticks, branches of a tree. Olaf is based on the United States-style snowman. Yeah, I know Frozen is set in a European kingdom, and Olaf should be a European-style snowman, but Olaf is pure American. If you want an illustration of the cultural divide across the Atlantic, there they are. Do you want to build a snowman? Yeah, but what kind of snowman? S is for snowman. But before we leave the snowman, a bit more about The Snowman. A picture book by Raymond Briggs made into an animated film for Channel 4 in the UK in 1982 and shown on British TV every year since. This is a Christmas classic in Britain, a delightful magical story of a boy's snowman that comes to life and takes the boy flying to a wonderful snowy world of snowmen and Father Christmas. It's a beautiful, lovely film. The animated film has no words except for one song, Walking in the Air. It was sung on the original soundtrack by a 13-year-old choir boy called Peter Orty. Peter Orty's gone on to have a career as a professional opera singer. But about 7 years later, they wanted to use the song Walking in the Air for a commercial for Toys R Us. Of course, by then, Peter Orty's voice had broken. He couldn't sing it again. And they needed another recording of the song by someone with a similar boy chorister kind of voice. And they found another boy called Aled Jones. And this was a big hit in Britain. And Aled Jones has also gone on to a career as a singer and a presenter and a media personality. If you haven't seen The Snowman or heard the song, do check them out. But also read the book. It's a delight. This is the Christmas Alphabet Podcast, where S is for a snowman and The Snowman. Now on the Christmas Alphabet Podcast, S is for Saturnalia. Saturnalia is the Roman festival that many people think is the source of a lot of what we do at Christmas. Saturnalia was a festival to the god Saturn, who represented a good harvest and prosperity and wealth. The feast started being celebrated as a popular festival in about 200 BC, on the 17th of December. But it soon became a whole week of festivities going on until December the 23rd, and including the winter solstice. To the cry of Yo Saturnalia, there would be parties and feasting. These included role reversal, where slaves were treated to a banquet and free speech was encouraged. On one day of the feast, there would be an exchange of gifts, with children getting toys and adults giving small tokens to each other. a lot of midwinter festivities that followed on from that, even down to our own time, contain the remnants of Saturnalia. And it's possible that when the date was fixed to celebrate Christmas in the 4th century AD, it was fixed at that date to be a Christian alternative to Saturnalia. Although actually there's two problems with this. One is that the dates don't really fit, because Saturnalia was over by the 25th of December. And the second is that by the time Christmas started being celebrated, Saturnalia had pretty much run its course and was hardly being marked at all. So I think that theory doesn't really work. But what is true is that when Christmas became more secular in medieval Europe, and then again in Victorian England, a lot of the old Saturnalia customs were revived as a secular midwinter festival. S is for Saturnalia. And this is the Christmas Alphabet Podcast. Today we're looking at the letter S on the Christmas Alphabet Podcast. My name's Wayne, I'm your host based in Manchester in England. Thank you for being with us. Now, what I normally do at this stage of the podcast is to have a quick look at things that just missed out of the main listings. But as S is the busiest of all the letters, what I'm going to do today, I'm just going to have to leave out a lot of things, and I'm just going to mention three big Christmas songs, songs that I really like, that didn't make it to the end of the podcast, and then we'll finish with one song that I have a particular connection with. So here's my countdown of S songs that nearly made it to the end of the podcast. First of all, S is for Silver Bells.
Silver bells, silver bells, it's Christmas time in the city.
I really like the song Silver Bells, though I'm not sure I know why. It's from a film called The Lemon Drop Kid and was sung by Bob Hope and was, of course, a hit for Bing Crosby, who kept on achieving Christmas hits with songs sung by other people first. The song about lights going on and decorations going up through the city is gentle and has that lovely Christmas feel all through it. It was written in 1951 and it's of its time, but it still resonates with that festive anticipation of Christmas, even when you listen to it today. S is for Silver Bells. S is for Sleigh Ride, one of the sounds of Christmas. Sleigh Ride was first written as a tune, an instrumental piece for orchestra, complete with bells and horse noises, written by Leroy Anderson in 1948, and the words were added a couple of years later in 1950. The song, both music and words, evokes winter and snow with very much a Jingle Bells feel to it. And like Jingle Bells, it never mentions Christmas at all. The classic version is by the Ronettes on the Phil Spector Christmas Gift for You LP. It's a song that's really difficult to sing with odd timings and odd intervals between the notes, and the words are complex and quick. But it wouldn't be Christmas without a bit of S for Sleigh Ride. And my third song in this quick pick is S is for Santa Claus is Coming to Town. We're back to Santa again, and a lot of what we think we know about Santa is built into this song. All about Santa flying through the sky, flying into town with a list of good and naughty children in his hand and checking the list twice. This song comes from 1934, a bit earlier than a lot of our classic songs, and the time of the Great Depression. And the original version of this included verses about being charitable and looking out for those who will miss out on their Christmas toys.
Now Santa is a busy man, he has no time to play.
Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra recorded it first, and then, yeah, Bing Crosby got in on the act. Good old Bing. And many others have followed, including notable recent versions from Michael Bublé and Bruce Springsteen. Have you heard the Bruce Springsteen version? It's quite something. S is for Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
He's making a list and checking it twice. Gonna find out what's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town.
That's my three S songs for now. Sorry, no room for The Sussex Carol or Step Into Christmas or Susie Snowflake, Snoopy's Christmas, See Amid the Winter Snow, The Sands Day Carol, The Seven Joys of Mary, and The Terrible Santa Baby. This is the Christmas Alphabet Podcast, and today we're looking at the letter S. We like to finish our episodes with the story behind a Christmas song, and today our big song is S is for Silent Night. Anyone who knows me will not be surprised that that is my choice for today. One of the best trips of my life I made in December 2018. I went with my wife and my daughter to stay in Salzburg in Austria. In Salzburg, we visited the fortress on the hill. We did the Sound of Music tour and the Mozart tour and the Christmas markets. And we saw the Krampus Run, which I've told you about before in this podcast. But the main reason I was on that trip was to go to a village near Salzburg called Oberndorf. Because it was there, exactly 200 years previously, in 1818, that the carol Silent Night was written and first performed. And 200 years on, I just had to be there. Oberndorf is right on the border with Germany. In fact, you can walk across a river bridge into Germany. And the river and the marking out of that new national border is part of the story of the carol. It was because of the political upheavals after the Napoleonic Wars that a Catholic priest called Joseph Mohr went to Oberndorf to minister to the hard-working families who made their living on the boats that went up and down the river, who had been affected by all those political machinations that had been going on in the early 19th century. Mohr was also a musician and a poet. And he made friends with Franz Xaver Gruber, who was the local school teacher and also the organist at his church, the Church of St. Nicholas. Mohr was a progressive priest. He wanted to include the working people and their families in the life of the parish. On Christmas Eve 1818, Mohr remembered a poem he had written 2 years previously while he was a priest in another village called Mariapfar. He had been inspired by an altarpiece painting in his church there of a nativity scene. And the poem he wrote was Stille Nacht, Silent Night. That Christmas Eve morning, Mohr took the words that he had written to his friend and organist, Franz Gruber, and asked him if he could compose a tune for the words that they could sing together after midnight mass that very night. Gruber got to work and wrote a simple tune in waltz time, designed to be sung to a guitar by two male voices, with a simple refrain for a children's choir. It was to be a tune that would appeal to the working people of the town, a tune that could be quickly rehearsed and used at the end of Mass that night. By the end of the day, Mohr played the guitar and sang the lead. Gruber sang harmony, and the church children's choir joined in at the end of each verse with a repeated refrain. There are all sorts of stories connected with the writing of Silent Night. Stories about the organ breaking down, even about mice eating the bellows. Those stories are just not true. They're good stories, but they're a long way from the truth. If you go to Oberndorf today, as I did for the 200th anniversary in 2018, you'll find that the original St. Nicholas Church has gone. It got washed away in floods sometime after Moore's Day. But in its place is a tiny white chapel called the Silent Night Chapel, surrounded by a cluster of buildings dedicated to the carol, including the Silent Night Museum and the Silent Night Post Office. It is a beautiful place to visit and accessible from Salzburg on a short train ride. The carol, still unearthed, spread through the music of travelling folk singers who took it to different parts of Austria and then around the world. In 1859, the carol was translated into English by John Freeman, who was then the vicar at Trinity Church in New York City. Freeman came up with three verses in English, in the version we're most familiar with today, based on Moore's six verses in German, though there are a few different English versions around. In fact, the carol has been translated into 300 different languages across the world. The song is the world's favourite carol, sung in every church carol service and community carol service, everywhere you go across the world. It's been recorded many, many times. Spotify has 26,000 different versions of the song. The best-selling version of those of all time is by Bing Crosby, of course. And the most popular in Britain is a version by Sinead O'Connor. Silent Night, in its English version, loosely based on the German original, takes us to the heart of Christmas. A simple, sweeping melody and words that speak of peace and gentleness and a deep quiet. Into that peace shines the light of Christmas, a glory that streams from heaven and shines out of the face of the baby who is the Son of God. Those beams are the dawning of the redeeming grace, the touch of the love of God into the world. It's a beautiful sentiment, and it catches the truth of Christmas. S is for Silent Night. And this is the Christmas Alphabet Podcast. I'm your host, Wayne, and it's time to wrap up our extra long episode for the letter S. All the music on this podcast is in the public domain or used for review purposes. Please do subscribe to the Christmas Alphabet Podcast if you're not subscribed already, and do pass on the word to your friends if you would. You can follow us on social media. We're at Christmas Alphabet Podcast on Facebook, or at Christmas Alpha on Twitter, or Christmas Alphabet on Instagram. You hear this every time, but please do follow us. Leave us a review on Facebook or on Apple Podcasts or on whatever podcast software you use to listen to this. Our website is christmasalphabet.com, and you can send me a note through that by using the email address wayne@christmasalphabet.com. So come back for more alphabetical Christmas in 2 weeks, with Christmas objects starting with the letter T. Among our T's, we might well be looking at the Christmas tree. Why not? The 12 days of Christmas. Oh yes. The turkey gobble gobble. The Christmas truce in the First World War. And other T's. What would you include? Let me know. Please spread the word. Please click that subscribe. And may the joy of Christmas be with you all year round.